Yeah, so this title, I think, is actually going to be the second half of the talk, because I thought it'd be good to motivate the second half by telling you about work that we've already done looking at circuitry, and that also that, given that this is probably a very bimodal audience, people like Mitya and Armin that have read all the papers and heard me talk way too many times are going to get bored, and people that haven't seen any of what we've done before, I thought it's still worthwhile to kind of go back over some of the older work and introduce what we do know about circuitry to motivate why we need new methods, but also to sort of introduce, well, what do we don't know, what do we not know, how do we need to maybe think about things differently, and to hopefully allow this to be a springboard for discussions. So as I present some of the data about circuitry, I hope to do that more in a sort of a skeletal form. Even though all the slides are there, I don't want to dwell on them too long, because then we'll never get to some of the later stuff. But I hope that we can stop and discuss at any time somebody wants to. So in the first part of the talk, first half, it's not going to be so much about methods as about telling you what we have figured out about circuitry, and that basically things are fairly precise at many different levels of organization. And this is the slide that I've used to start talks for the last 10 years or so. I don't know how many now heard Chuck talk and have his writing on the board and nice outlines to start with, but hearing him give a talk is what made me make this slide in the first place, I've been using it ever since. So essentially, if we want to understand how circuits give rise to behavior and perception, we of course have to know what is the circuit, and that's something we've been working very hard on and beginning to understand at finer and finer levels of resolution, and gradually get to more sort of satisfying relationships between circuits and function. We have to correlate circuitry to function, and then we have to have ways of perturbing circuits, because all of this is very complex, and it's not just a static circuit, it's a very dynamic circuit that's changing from millisecond to millisecond and on multiple timescales. So we need to have ways of perturbing circuitry at multiple timescales, and with the kind of resolution at which the circuits exist. We've for a long time had circuit diagrams, particularly for the visual system, where we can say, well, here are dozens of different cortical areas, they have different functions, and they're connected up in different ways. And that really still hasn't been particularly satisfying for really having a mechanistic view of how the transformations are taking place. Why are the visual responses of these neurons at a higher area different than the ones at a lower area? We've known for a long time, since Hubel and Wiesel, and probably even before that, that the cortex has layers and columns, and that there are functional differences between neurons in these layers and columns. I'm going to very briefly talk about some work that we did 10, 15 years ago related to the organization of connections at this level related to function. But mostly what we're going to talk about is the fact that within any given piece of cortex, there are many different types of neurons whose dendrites and axons are all intertwined, and this poses real challenges for trying to figure out wiring, who's connected to who. And even neurons of the same type that are right next to each other can be connected very differently. So that's mostly what we're going to focus on is this sort of level of what I'm calling microcircuits here. So way back in the 1990s, ages ago, we filled a whole bunch of neurons with dye in the visual cortex of monkeys. And in the primary visual cortex of monkeys, there's really a wealth of knowledge about the functional properties of neurons in different layers and modules. And based on that, we sort of put together a sort of skeletal view of how information might flow through the cortex, and which also made the point that not all parts of the circuit are serving the same function. that you can't think of all excitatory connections as being the same. Probably what's going on is that part of the reason different excitatory connections are different is the way they're interacting with inhibitory circuits. So you'll see in a minute that I'm going to say that certain of these connections we can define as being sort of having a strong influence on what's the neurons that receive them, whereas others are more modulatory. And when we say modulatory, we basically mean we just don't know what it does. So here we can see that in the primary visual cortex, input from the thalamus that comes from the retina goes mostly to the middle layer, layer 4, with some axon collaterals to layer 6. And these are some examples of excitatory neurons in these different layers, with dendrites in blue and axons in yellow. And these neurons in layer 4 send their densest axons to layer 2, 3, and that's where we find the neurons that then send axons out to the next higher cortical area in a hierarchy. So that's sort of the most direct way to get information flowing from one cortical area to the next. But then what do we do with these other neurons in the deeper layers that also send axons back? And if we look at functional relationships between different functional modules in the cortex and the specificity of these axons relative to that, we can come up with this kind of thing where we'll say that, you know, these inputs from LGN to layer 4 and 4 to 2-3 and 2-3 to the next cortical area sort of are very closely related functionally to the properties of the neurons that are receiving the input, whereas these other neurons, the neurons in layer 6 that project to 4C or 5 that connect to 2-3, they don't respect these functional modules, so they appear to be modulatory in that sense. But, you know, really that's, I mean, in a lot of ways a cop-out, but this sort of idea that the input to LGN, to 4C, to 2-3 is the way that information is flowing through the cortex influences what we think quite a bit. And the rest of this is more of a mystery. There are, of course, also neurons in these deeper layers that make subcortical projections, so we shouldn't think of this as the only output. And there are multiple outputs to multiple extrastriate areas, so it's really a lot more complicated. But this is a framework for helping us organize our thoughts. So then we're going to get to microcircuits, and the what we're going to focus on are inhibitory neurons, in part because we can distinguish them from each other very, very easily, but also because probably these are very important in shaping the way that different excitatory inputs influence activity in the network. And more we're going to start thinking about dynamics and how things are working on a dynamic level and how these different types of inhibitory neurons influence that. That's going to be further down the road as we learn more about what's going on. But for now, I want to show you that these different inhibitory neuron types are connected very differently in the cortex. And we can distinguish inhibitory neurons from each other based on differences in their morphologies, difference in their intrinsic firing properties, their intrinsic physiology, differences in, say, neuropeptides that they might release from their axons or other markers. Like parvalbumin, that is a calcium binding protein. At any rate, we're going to put these. Yeah.
So, something, the statement on that previous. Sorry, that slide.
This one or?
No, the inhibitory cell slide. So, the statement is staining for a certain peptide or co-release of a certain peptide with GABA also correlates strongly with your anatomy. Mm-hmm. But, Nietzsche, I think you have a paper in cerebral cortex where sort of had a more of a continuum of shapes. Do you believe this? No, I mean, I'm really asking if you can see the shape under DIC scope. You just look under DIC scope, you can see a pyramidal cell, you can slice, you can see the little neurons around the pyramidal cell in the slice. And your statement is that I can look at the shape of the pyramidal cell, I can make a pretty good guess as to what it's going to co-release. I better remember one of your papers saying that there's a continuum. You couldn't just talk about big basket cells and little basket cells.
Was it Henry Markham?
No, it was yours.
We did that with Armin, actually. Yeah. But those predictions don't always work because this is just geometry. So they give some first order idea, but actually Ed has experimental evidence that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
I'm not sure if I'm quite following exactly, but saying
the shape of the cell and make
morphology alone. Yeah.
Morphology
so,
alone.
So in fact,
a pretty good prediction of what it's going to cover you.
At the level of DIC optics, no, and it depends on the cell type. So you could say fill a cell with dye and look at its morphology, and you might be able to get a sense that it's a multipolar cell versus a cell that maybe only has two dendrites, something like that can help you define cells better. But even cells that might look multipolar, basket cells, you probably wouldn't be able just from that to be certain that you've got this cell type and not that cell type. You would have to combine that with something like antibody staining for parvalbumin or cholecystokinin that could help you to distinguish these. If you were recording from this cell and looked at its intrinsic physiology, it would be different from this cell.
Yeah.
This is the one cell type that if you record from it and see its intrinsic physiology, that it's fast spiking and that is non-accommodating, you'll see some examples of that later, you could say, okay, I got a fast spiking basket cell. Now, whether there are still additional subdivisions of fast spiking basket cells, there probably are, but we don't have good ways right now of defining them. Markram has defined more sort of anatomical types that he thinks they can see. I'm not sure that those are really distributions that are distinct. But as we get to know more about genes that are expressed in different cell types, things that the Allen Institute is doing now with double in situs, might be able to define more cell types more clearly. But at any rate, it is clear that there are probably a dozen or so distinct cell types for sure, that with a combination of antibody staining, morphology, intrinsic firing, things like that, you can distinguish. And you're going to see here that we're going to define 9 cell types based on these combinations of methods that we can distinctly separate.
Are any of these peptides or parvalbumin reliable indicators of a discrete cell type?
It depends on how you define the cell type, right? Because to a certain extent, you can define them as being definitely distinct from some other group, but whether or not there are further subdivisions that we might need to make later, and the answer really does depend on which peptide and things. So, for example, somatostatin pretty much does correspond to cells that have a particular morphology. You'll see later these Martinotti cells, but then it turns out in mouse at least we can separate that into 2 further types. For sort of subtypes of Martinotti cells. Right. So it's complicated, and we're basically, we and others try to use whatever combinations of things we can measure reliably to try to know that we're recording from a particular cell type, and mouse genetics is helping us a lot there too.
How homogeneous is the pyramidal cell population?
How homogeneous is it? It depends on the species and the cortical area that you're looking at. Homogeneous, for sure, there are differences when you say layer 2-3 pyramidal cells are different than layer 5 or layer 6 pyramidal cells. In some places like, say, rat visual cortex, all the layer 2-3 pyramidal cells look like they might be pretty much the same, but it could turn out that there are different types. Other places like monkey layer 6 pyramidal cells, we can define 9 different anatomical types that correlate with differences in where the cells project their axons, both locally and to distant targets. And, you know, monkey primary visual cortex is really probably one of the more unusual areas where even in superficial layers we can define different cell types anatomically, and especially based on where they project their cells differently, to V2, to V3, to MT. Those are all separate populations generally.
I think Nat Hines had a number of several dozen different types of pyramidal cells based on gene expression on the GenSet project. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
I think that to be
I
haven't seen any data from that shows that. I think that what I would want to see to convince me you had a different cell type was that there are, you know, sort of a conservative way to approach it would be sort of things that are not overlapping in their distribution, and maybe 2 parameters at least that are not overlapping and don't correlate. So, for example, layer 5 pyramidal cells either project subcortically or make cortical-cortical projections and never both. And those have, if you look at the morphology of the dendritic arbors, you can measure quantitatively the total apical dendritic length, say, you'll see that those are non-overlapping between those populations. So there you're pretty confident you've got different cell types. But that's not to say that later we might not have another parameter that we can measure that would separate those. But as far as I know from the GenSat data, I don't know of something that really does that systematically. And then you also have to worry about things like just because you see genes that are not overlapping in their expression, you don't know that maybe tomorrow that cell might be expressing that gene and it wasn't today, or that a quantitative difference that you can't detect from methods that are not quantitative might matter in some way. So it's defining cell types is really a work in progress. And in some cases, we can be sure we've got different cell types, and in other cases, we still don't know. So here, though, one main point is going to be related to, what kind of methods do you need to be able to define circuitry? That is, can we make light-level anatomical observations and draw a circuit diagram? So, if you have all these different cell types that all have dendrites in layer 2, 3, and you say, okay, here's a bunch of different cells that all send axons to layer 2, 3, can we just look at the density of axons and dendrites and infer what the circuit is? Or are these axons from, say, layer 5, when they arborize in this area, can they selectively connect to some cells and avoid others? And the answer is that there are very selective connections. They can selectively connect to some and avoid others. So that's sort of one level of question we might ask, and that tells us that we do have to pay attention to cell types, and different cell types are differently, and probably that contributes to the different ways that they mediate function in the cortex. Also the specifics of the connections, where do they get their input from, probably will eventually be important and tell us something. But that's not something we're necessarily going to get to today. So the way that we can reveal differences in functional input to different cells is to record intracellularly in a brain slice and then stimulate neurons locally by uncaging glutamate. So all of the neurons will be responsive to glutamate that's uncaged, but only neurons close by fire action potentials. So you're using light to stimulate. You can stimulate hundreds of sites and essentially make a map of the input to a cell. And you can make separate excitatory and inhibitory input maps by doing voltage clamp recording and either holding the cell near the reversal potential for chloride so you can map excitatory inputs, or depolarizing the cell to where you can better see inhibitory outward currents. So here's from a paper published 7 years ago, a map of the excitatory input to a layer 2-3 pyramidal cell in rat visual cortex. And this is essentially is what you would expect if you looked at the anatomy and you saw that the densest axons to layer 2-3 come from layer 4 and within layer 2-3, and you get weaker input from the deeper layers. And
so to exclude direct stimulation, then you just look at the latency of the first rise.
Yeah. So this is all in published papers from a while ago. So if you record directly from neurons in loose patch, so that you can see the timing of action potentials that are generated following glutamate uncaging, or you record intracellularly so you can see sort of what's happening. As soon as the glutamate's released, you immediately see some depolarization of the cell, but there's always at least 5 milliseconds before a spike is generated. So if you plot the distribution of times of spikes, the first spikes that can be activated are 5 milliseconds, and then they extend out to 150 or so milliseconds. And sometimes depolarization is very slow, and then you reach threshold later. A direct response to glutamate is immediate. So if you see a response, which I don't have any here, I don't think. But well, if we stimulated right at the cell body, you would see something that was immediate depolarization of the cell, and it would also be a much slower rise time than these synaptic currents are. So if we see something like that, we know that's a direct response. And then we can also see the synaptic currents riding on top of that and separately extrapolate the synaptic current out from the direct response. Occasionally, there's such a big direct response that you can't resolve synaptic currents on top of that. So in some cases, there might be underestimates of the amount of local input because of that.
So that current then is an integral over all the spikes of the long time?
This value in picoamps here, in the case of these plots from this paper, we sum together the peaks of the synaptic currents, the amplitudes, sum them all together. And so each stimulation site, so they're discrete sites 50 microns apart, and each site gets a value in picoamps based on that analysis. And then in addition, to make this plot, we've subtracted out the value from spontaneous activity from trials that are interleaved here. And that's subtracted away. That's why this looks very much zero here.
Is there additional information? Because you also then, you could have made a plot, you imagine, that goes, has time. And so you could have just chunked time.
Yeah, we've tried to, some of the things you might imagine you can get from time, if you had good temporal control of when action potentials are activated from this kind of stimulus, would be that, well, you maybe stimulate multiple action potentials in some cells, so maybe later in time you might have more synaptic currents occurring later, or the amplitude might be different because of facilitation or depression, things like that. But in the end, all of those analyses we could do didn't really show up anything reliable, and we also felt that it was just impossible to infer what they meant, because we didn't know the distributions of times of all the action potentials, and you couldn't correlate a specific synaptic current with whether that current came from the first spike or second spike from the cell, because there are multiple cells that are activated, and the distribution of timing of the synaptic of the action potentials that are generated is so variable that I think we just can't resolve that with this method. If you want to know things about dynamics, you should do paired recordings or use other methods where you have very reliable timing of the action potentials that are generated. Okay. And then fast spiking inhibitory cells also receive a very similar pattern of input. And there are a number of observations in vivo recordings that people like Harvey Swadlow and many others have done that would suggest that these fast spiking inhibitory neurons, which typically receive the same kinds of inputs as the pyramidal cells that are right next to them, are very much involved in gain control, feed-forward inhibition, as well as local feedback inhibition from the connections from pyramidal cells to them. And then you can see that they really focus their inhibitory connections onto the area around them, which is the pyramidal cells. And you'll see a little bit more of that kind of organization at an even finer level of specificity later. And then Jamie saw that adapting interneurons, which was basically meant they weren't fast spiking, we didn't know what they were at the time, fell into two different groups. So this told us that there was specificity, but it didn't really tell us about what the inputs were to these different cell types. So more recently, we've been able to use transgenic mice to sample more routinely from more rare inhibitory cell types, and also to be more sure about what cell type we're really recording from. Because in the cases before we saw adapting interneurons, it's not always possible to get good antibody staining of neurons because you dialyze the cells when you record from them, or you need to use a particular antibody to mark a particular cell type, but you don't know what cell type you might have, so you might use the wrong antibody, and so it's very, very difficult. So,
sorry, can we just go back to the previous? So the point then is that you have two classes of interneurons in the same layer that are getting hit by the same axons, and yet they don't seem to be connected to the same cells.
Sure, yeah. So you could infer from this that if this is in fact a distinctly different cell type from this type, well, so this was a bimodal distribution. The adapting cells in the population that was sampled, either got their input primarily from deep layers and not as much from superficial layers, or from superficial and not deep. And those populations themselves didn't overlap, and were clearly, had, if you plotted layer 2, 3 versus layer 5 input, they're sort of separate clouds that were not overlapping.
Are you trying to argue that's a violation of Peter's rule, or?
Yeah, sure, it certainly is. So the question is this a violation of Peter's rule? And there are a huge number of observations, not just from my lab, but others that show that connections are more specific than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, but just this particular example, this is definitely a violation of Peter's rule?
Yes, and so for example, So Peter's rule is the idea that you can look at the density of axons from some source and density of dendrites, and the connectivity will be proportional to that overlap. A violation of that would be what happens if those axons selectively avoid some dendritic elements in the area, and or selectively synapse onto others. And it's clear that Peter's rule is wrong in many cases.
But in this particular case, it's hard to understand. So, but the dendrites aren't really in the same place.
In terms of the cloud of axons that come from layer 5, they are. You know, Mitch has done a lot more, and Armin, much more quantitatively looking at the overlap from those. And although they, you know, they haven't compared input to different inhibitory cell types, but I think it's pretty clear that you know that you'll see examples later of cells that don't get much, if any, layer 4 input, and there's no doubt that layer 4 overlaps with axons overlap with the dendrites of these cells. So this isn't something that's you know been done quantitatively asking for the exact same cells, what's the density of axons and dendrites, but it's so obviously different from that that there's little doubt that there's specificity.
And just to follow up briefly on what you were saying, I think another very clear example, as you're saying, many, of specificity is from the chandelier cell connection. So that's inhibitory onto axon initial segment. And there are various papers, I think predominantly from Dave Felipe group, but also Ed Lewis in frontal lobe, and maybe Ed White, giving very clear data of specificity of for those connections in relation to certain parameter cell connectional subpopulations.
And there are EM studies looking at connections from various sources on to the different dendritic elements in places. So. So this is not so much about giving you a quantitative description as to what extent that rule is violated. I think it's pretty clear that it's violated a lot. But what we're more interested in here eventually will be what are the inputs to different cells. So more recently, Xiangming Xu has been taking advantage of a few different lines of transgenic mice in which green fluorescent protein is expressed selectively in subpopulations of inhibitory cells. And from mouse to mouse, the population of cells that's labeled is the same. And it's not really known how this happened, these expression patterns. All of the lines that I'm going to tell you about used GAD promoters inserted randomly into the genome, different fragments of the GAD promoter for the different lines. That's probably not the reason why. It's probably related to where randomly this construct got inserted into the genome. There are three lines of mice that were used. One is a G42 line from Josh Wong's lab, and the great majority of cells that are green in this line are the fast spiking inhibitory cells, but it also turns out that chandelier cells are labeled. These are these axoaxonic cells. You'll see a picture of those in the next slide. The gin mice, so here's a picture of them, and everything I'm telling you about is going to be layer 3 neurons that we've characterized carefully in these mice. These all have the morphology of Martinotti cells. These are cells that are multipolar cells that send axons to layer 1, and they come, turns out, in two types, ones that express calretinin and ones that don't. And then the G30 line doesn't overlap at all with any of these populations, but it has a whole bunch of different cell types that are expressing GFP, including cells that we can distinguish just from their morphology, these neurogliaform cells. I'm not going to show a picture of them, but I don't have time to go to all this. Bipolar cells that just have only two primary dendrites, and then multipolar cells, which we can separate into three groups based on their firing properties. So in some cases, like what we're going to call burst spiking and regular spiking cells, we don't know exactly how these might correspond to some other groups of cells that could be defined. But for regular, for irregular spiking cells, we know these are CCK-expressing cells that have cannabinoid receptors on their presynaptic terminals. So we can, in the live slice, see the cells, aim our electrodes to them, record their intrinsic firing properties, fill them with dye, and characterize them further. So this is a fast spiking basket cell from the G42 line. Here's a chandelier cell. You can see these axon cartridges that are characteristic of these cells. And we can map inputs, and we see the fast spiking cells now in the mouse barrel cortex, because mouse has a better defined barrel cortex than visual cortex, and it's easier for us to get at. Has the same pattern of inputs as fast spiking cells in the rat visual cortex. We can see examples where different cell types here, the different kinds of Martinotti cells. So if it were darker, you'd see the axons going up to layer one. We have a publication in JCN that describes these different types of Martinotti cells that have calretinin or not. They have slightly different dendritic morphologies and slightly different firing properties. But it turns out that one population of cells gets very balanced input from layer 4 and 2, 3, and the other gets much stronger input from layer 2, 3 than layer 4. And then it turns out there are a bunch of cell types that get this pattern of input where they get strong excitation from layer 2, 3 and layer 5A, which in the mouse barrel cortex is where the paralimniscal input from the thalamus goes to, rather than to layer 4 that gets the limniscal input. So there's this gap in layer 4. And then for this particular cell type, which are these irregular spiking basket cells, the pattern of inhibitory input mimics the pattern of excitatory input. But for another cell type, the regular spiking cells in the same line, the pattern of inhibitory input is different. So this tells us that not only are excitatory inputs different for different cell types, but there are also differences in inhibitory input to different cell types. But despite the fact that we looked at 9 different inhibitory cell types, we can, I don't know what happened to our difference between layer 2, 3 and layer 4, but this top bar in all these cases is layer 2, 3. They fall into roughly 3 groups of cells based on patterns of excitatory input. So first, all of the inhibitory cell types get strong excitation from within layer 2, 3. So where they differ from each other, and they get very little input from layer 5B or 6. So where they differ is really in how much input they get from layer 5 or layer 4. So there are some cells like these here that have this relatively weak input from layer 4 and strong from layer 5. Cells like this that get stronger input from layer 4 relative to layer 5, and then these cells that get little input from 4 or 5, mostly just from layer 2, 3. And in this three-dimensional plot, you can see those 3 separate groups. But it turns out that the patterns of inhibitory input to different cells, which are also cell type specific, don't are not predictable from the patterns of excitatory input. So if I go back to the here, I've color-coded these, the red, green, and blue groups.
So here, you think you could split things up according to this one, part of this one, inputs?
These...
The prediction would be you could put a dye in the right way, or color pop something in your favorite virus, and you might actually label different parts of the dyes.
Well, if we put it in layer 3, so I think if you're saying, if we were to be able to trace back from a cell type, to layer 5 cells to the thalamus, that that presumably these excitatory inputs from layer 5A, those cells presumably are receiving paralimniscal input, right?
But that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to go one, two cells back, right?
With the tracing methods.
Yeah.
With the tracing method that I'm going to talk about later, we can go one cell back, right? There are ways we could modify it in the future to go yet another cell back. And so I think we could eventually answer that to directly show that. But yeah, because we're not directly showing here that, you know, we don't know necessarily that the layer 5 excitatory neurons that project here are receiving that input. I think they almost certainly are, because, you know, the layer 5 cells, they're more than one type of layer 5 cell, but the layer 5 cell, there's only one type that sends axons to layer 3. So those must be the ones that provide this input. And I don't know that anybody's done EM to show that the paralimniscal input may or may not selectively target one or the other type of pyramidal cell. Yeah, so it's all in vivo recordings and slices, and I was quickly going through the day, but it's all recordings from at least 10 cells of each type, and then the numbers are based on compiling the data from all of those cells and pooling it together.
Photo on page where the radius of that region of glutamate release exceed the diameter of the slice?
Yeah, what's relevant isn't the region of glutamate release. The region of glutamate release is very tiny. It's a diffraction limited spot. There's light scattered, and then the glutamate's released in a tiny spot, and then it diffuses over some distance at which it's effective. And that distance is probably on the order of 5 microns or so. If you have a dendrite of a cell you're recording from, and you go along a few microns at a time, you'll see that you hit right on the dendrite, you'll see depolarization of the cell. You move 5 microns away, you'd see nothing. So what defines the resolution isn't the uncaging of the glutamate. It's the distance out on a cell's dendritic arbor that, with the particular concentration of glutamate that we use and the light level that we use, will depolarize it enough to make it fire an action potential. So as you move further and further out on the dendrite, the probability you get an action potential gets lower and lower. And so the resolution of the method here is sort of on the order of 50 microns. And so so this is sort of in the XY dimension and not in the Z dimension. So things like this where you see a gap in the input from layer 4, you know, this is probably an overestimate of the input from layer 4, because when we stimulate, you can see that the input that we're seeing is at these edges where we could be activating cells at the bottom of layer 3 or the top of layer 5, even though we're stimulating layer 4. But I mean, the point is that there are differences between cells, not only in the excitatory input, but in the inhibitory input, and you can't predict excitation from inhibition. So there are 3 patterns of excitatory input, but if you now incorporate inhibitory input, there are more patterns. And so anyway, there's cell type specificity of connections, and that's true not only for inhibitory neurons, but also for pyramidal neurons, and we've talked about that. And then I think I want to go very quickly through this part, but in terms of data, but show more of the schematic diagrams. So it turns out that in cortex, say we look at in any cortical area, any species, you look at 2 pyramidal cells that are right next to each other, the probability that they're connected directly is usually on the order of 10 or 20%. And as you move further away, that drops off so quickly that we don't really even know what the numbers are for 50 or 100 microns away, because nobody wants to sample enough cell pairs to say whether, you know, there's a statistically significant difference between the connections being 3% or 1% or 6%, because you'd have to have hundreds of pairs. And this is also true if you sample vertically, say from layer 4 to 2, 3, you see about the same rate of connectivity. So one wonders then whether neurons that are connected to each other share common input or not. And it turns out from many different kinds of experiments with triplet recordings or four cells at a time, and experiments that we've done with the photostimulation method, that when two layer 2-3 cells are connected to each other, they share common input. And the way that we've demonstrated that is to take advantage of the fact that when we uncage glutamate, there's a population of neurons that fire action potentials, but they fire them asynchronously. So there's temporal information in the time, information in the times at which we see synaptic currents that allows us to infer whether the two cells we record from simultaneously share input or not. So if the synaptic currents come at the exact same time, there's a high probability that that means that a cell that was activated here had an axon that made synaptic contacts to both cells. We also showed that these connections are very reliable, more than 90% reliable, so there's a high probability that if you see a synaptic current in one cell and not the other cell, that it means that there was a cell that was stimulated that connected to one and not the other. So you can do cross-correlation analysis of the times of synaptic currents and calculate how much shared input two cells have. So here we can see that two layer 2-3 pyramidal cells for all the stimulation sites in layer 2-3, we make a cross-correlogram, we see a big peak, and we can do a shifted correlogram, which estimates how much of the synchronous activation is due to just the fact that you have cells that you've stimulated that fire, two different cells that fire action potentials at the same time, and we can subtract that out and calculate that roughly 30% of the inputs to one cell will be shared by the other cell for stimulation of whatever cells we stimulated in layer 3 over this whole region. And similarly for layer 4, and then about 10% for layer 3. So this is in these rare cases where the layer 2-3 pyramids are directly connected to each other. If they're not connected, you don't see peaks in the correlograms, and across all of the whole population of connected or unconnected cells, you can see that these correlation probabilities, the amount of shared input, depends on whether the cells are connected or not, at least for layer 2-3 and layer 4, but not for layer 5. So we can make a diagram like this where we say, oh, there's these relatively independent subnetworks of neurons in a cortical column. This is an exaggeration, it's a cartoon. It's about 30%, maybe 20 to 30% input that's shared for two cells that are connected. That means the majority of inputs are actually not shared. So that's not illustrated here. So that's true for connections from 4 to 2-3. But from layer 5, those connections seem to not respect these subnetworks. We looked at a lot of different inhibitory cell types.
And so buried in these numbers is the fact that the probability of release is still small in each synapse.
Mm-hmm. So what's so relevant...
There's no notion of pair pulse facilitation.
Yeah, so what David asks is, says that's buried in this is that the probability of release is very low at individual synapse. So what's relevant here is not the probability of release at an individual synapse, but the probability that when one cell is connected to another cell and has probably multiple contacts, so the few cases that's been shown, like from layer 4 to layer 2-3, there are about 5 synaptic contacts. So what's the reliability of that unitary connection as opposed to a single synaptic connection? And so we did paired recordings between these populations, and in these cases they were, that's in supplementary information in the paper, but it's greater than 95% reliability. So the shared input might be a little bit of an underestimate because of that. Those rare cases where you might get, you know, see a response in one cell and not the other, even though you stimulated a cell that goes to both. So then, just to summarize data from another paper, it turned out that the fast spiking inhibitory neurons have sort of a special relationship to these fine scale subnetworks. That when fast spiking inhibitory neurons are, they turn out to selectively connect to the same pyramidal cells that excite them locally within layer 2-3. And when there is a reciprocal connection like this, they share common input from layer 4. So this, again, fits with this idea of fast spiking inhibitory neurons providing both feed forward and feedback in addition. But now we can see that that's selective even at the level of these fine scale subnetworks, not just within a column. And then Kampa, Letzkus, and Stewart.
Musical connection, that's from paired recording?
Yeah, so we do paired recordings between fast spiking cell, pyramidal cell, and then directly assess the connectivity between those. And it turns out that if there's a one-way connection from a fast spiking cell to a pyramidal cell, they don't share common input from 4 or within layer 2, 3. But if it's reciprocal, they do. And then they made this interesting observation that if they record from 3 cells, 2 in layer 5, 1 in layer 2, 3, if the layer 5 cells are connected to each other, that they will, if this layer 2, 3 cell connects to one, it'll connect to both. So they share common input from layer 2, 3, just like we'd expect for the subnetworks I told you about, say, from layer 4 to 2, 3. But what's a little surprising is that then if they record from layer 2, 3 cells in a layer 5 cell, they find out that if the layer 2, 3 cells are connected to each other, they will not converge onto this layer 5 cell. Layer 2, 3 cells connected, they don't converge on the layer 5 cell. It's when they're not connected that they converge onto the same layer 5 cell. So this sort of suggests that you're, I was trying to make this slide this morning and couldn't get it to go into to the PowerPoint. So this sort of suggests that from layer 2, 3 to layer 5, you're setting up an orthogonal subnetwork. So if layer 5 cells are connected to each other, they share input from the same layer 2, 3 cells, but they're not layer 2, 3 cells that belong to the same fine scale subnetwork. So you're sort of sampling across subnetworks in layer 5 and creating some new orthogonal subnetwork. So that'll be interesting to see how that then in turn relates to connections back to layer 2, 3. So this is still sort of understanding things at this fine scale is still a work in progress, and there's a lot still to be learned.
And are you pointing towards the idea that in this fine scale there's a bunch of different assemblies ready to go that are possibly oscillating at gamma frequencies?
Yeah, so gamma frequencies, you're asking because of the fast spiking cells.
Right.
Yeah, that would be the implication of the connectivity of the fast spiking cells, is that the population of neurons that would be coherently generating gamma activity might be a subset. I think that might depend further on some things we don't know, like the direct connectivity between those inhibitory cells, the gap junction coupling between the inhibitory cells, the things that generate gamma. So that may or may not be the case. But certainly in terms of the connectivity between pyramidal cells and fast spiking cells, the reciprocal connectivity that exists is related to these subnetworks. And then you also sort of asked about whether, you know, is the idea that there are multiple sort of subnetworks. I think that's probably true. They're relatively independent, but they're not completely independent because you've got another 70% of the connections that are not, you know, specific for this. So there's lots of room for the circuit to be changing dynamically, but there's biases within the circuit. So that's for you guys to dream up. What's it doing, right? So given all this specificity, that's sort of at the level of resolution that's beyond the sort of traditional techniques that we have for perturbing circuits or relating circuitry to function, what are we going to do about that to be able to approach things at this finer level of specificity? And one way to do that is to take advantage of genetic methods. You already saw the transgenic mice that have GFP in specific cell types. Well, you can use genetic methods to express all kinds of different genes that could allow you to perturb the activity of cells by stimulating them or inhibiting them, or I'm going to show you an example of a way to trace the connections to cells that are defined genetically or to even a single cell. But I wanted to briefly talk about sort of where things are at in terms of this promise for using genetic methods to target specific cell types. Because a lot of the things we'd like to do aren't going to necessarily be in mice. A lot of real nice behavior can be done in monkeys. So if we're correlating circuitry to behavior, so we'd like to have approaches to do that. So where is sort of the field at with respect to being able to use genetic methods to target cell types? In terms of mice, it's finally getting there, and there are lots of transgenic mice that are being generated. It's not turning out that the methods that people thought were going to be the best early on, like making back transgenics, are the way that that works, because those methods are not reliable. So people are more and more using knock-ins, where they insert a piece of DNA into a predefined locus and let the endogenous promoter in its endogenous context try to recapitulate expression. And so there are better ways now to do that without influencing the expression of those genes. And people are now expressing things that are more generic, like Cre recombinase or TET transactivators, that can be crossed with lines of mice that will have expression of some other gene of use, like a calcium indicator or something that allows you to activate cells that's dependent on that. So you can cross the lines, or you can make a viral vector that will have Cre-dependent expression of something to do that. So that's where things are at in mice. We still need lots of lines, and people are just starting to generate them, but that will get there pretty quickly. But when we don't have mice, we need to use viral vectors. And there are good vectors that can efficiently infect neurons in the brain. But then the challenge is, and these can give stable expression for years without killing cells, but the challenge is getting expression restricted to particular cell types. And we've tried very hard to get these working for several years now. And the fact that, first of all, it doesn't even work in a transgenic mouse very well, it shouldn't be a surprise that it works even more poorly in viral vectors put into adult animals. One method that does work well is to make a virus that infects through axon terminals. So in a lot of cases, there are different types of pyramidal neurons that are all next to each other, but they send axons to different distant locations. So if you put a virus in those distant locations, you can selectively infect different cell types. So that works, and there are many different kinds of viruses, like adenovirus that Kathy has shown can do that nicely. So that's one place where we can do things probably already in monkeys or other species. And another thing that our lab is working on, but I'm not going to talk about today, and we have one case where this is working well now, is to engineer viruses that only infect certain cell types by taking advantage of the fact that viruses infect cells through cell surface receptors, and we can identify cell surface receptors that are expressed on one cell type and not another. And then if those have genetically encodable ligands, we can engineer proteins, bridge proteins that serve as a bridge between a envelope protein of a virus and that receptor. And we've got one of these that seems to be working in vivo now. So there's some hope that we'll have more and more of this, but that's pretty new and still not routine. I don't want to take the time to show this. This is published, but basically, one would like to be able to target a specific cell type using a genetic method and have a gene you can express to be able to selectively inactivate neurons. A lot of you are probably familiar with channel rhodopsin, which works beautifully, that Carl Dieseroth, Ed Boyd, and others have worked with. We developed a method that's expressing a gene which is activated by a ligand that you put into the brain. This causes potassium channels to open. And it's selective because this ligand doesn't activate anything endogenous to the mammalian brain, and there's nothing in the mammalian brain that activates this receptor. When you open all these potassium channels, neurons are inactivated. And I'm not going to spend our time on this. Basically, it works. It's reversible on a time scale of as fast as you can get ligand in and washed out. And it can completely eliminate responses to strong stimuli, like in the visual system. If you have the strongest visual stimulus for a particular neuron in monkey LGN, you can eliminate responsiveness to that. So that's a method that works and is available, and there are several labs now using that. So what I want to focus on more is what Sarah alluded to at the very beginning was, okay, what about sort of doing connectomics? And I think that there are going to be different methods that need to be used to get at different kinds of questions. So, for example, things like what Sebastian is working on to do 3D, complete reconstruction of a chunk of brain could give you the whole picture for that chunk of brain and do things like allow you to ask whether connections from one cell to another are dependent on some other connection, like what we start to get at with the photostimulation impaired recordings. But it's probably going to be some time before we can do a whole brain. And so if you have even what would be extremely difficult to do, a chunk of cortex that's a millimeter cube and will give huge amounts of valuable information, you still don't know how that relates to connections to the thalamus or cortical connections from other deeper brain structures. So a complementary method would be to be able to pick out one neuron in here and label all of the inputs to just that one neuron across the whole brain, and then go and find those all in a brain and do that over and over again for many different cell types and many examples of each cell type. So so we have a method that I think will make that possible. And the data I'm going to show you are proof of principle in slice cultures, so you shouldn't take this as information about connectivity in the cortex, because these slice cultures don't have they have some aspects of their connections that are probably similar to in vivo, but not all of them. So here's a picture of one of these slice cultures. There are a lot of green neurons, and they're green because they are infected with a rabies virus that has a green fluorescent protein coding sequence inserted into its genome. And the way they got infected with the rabies virus is that the rabies virus was first delivered to a single neuron. This one that you can barely see here is yellow. At higher power here, you can see it's expressing a red fluorescent protein as well as the green fluorescent protein here, so it looks yellow in this picture. So the rabies virus was made to initially infect just this one neuron, and then it spread across a single synaptic step to these other neurons. And so there are essentially two things that we've done to modify the rabies virus relative to what normally would have happened if we just put rabies in here. We've made it so it only infected that one neuron to begin with. So we have a method to modify the rabies in a way that we can cause it to only selectively infect certain cells. And then it spread only one synaptic step rather than continuing to spread across multiple synaptic steps. So there are two kinds of modifications we have to do. We have to get it so it only infects certain cells, and so it only goes one synapse and then stops. And the way, yeah?
Can you go back to the previous talk? Can you read anything into the fact that if you look across styles of what it sort of looks like, it's sort of a gap, right?
This?
Yeah, are those actually...
No, that's, well, I don't know what that is in this particular slice, but it could be some kind of, like I said, anything in this slice culture is just, it's a tool for having a set of neurons that are connected. And there is Lammer specificity that develops normally in slice culture. This is made from a two-day-old rat, and then it's been cultured for 7 or 8 days by the time you see this. So a lot of connections are being formed and developing. We've used these cultures for studying development of circuitry kind of in isolation of extrinsic factors. This, I don't know what it is. It's not in every slice. It might be some population of cells that's dying. It could be, you know, someplace where the slice gets thicker. I think if you made took a section from a normal in vivo brain, you wouldn't see this. But I don't, and we don't see this in all the slices. So it's just there in this one, and I don't know what it is.
So how many neurons does it spread to in the first step, roughly?
Well, that's a good question, and I hope all of them. And that's something that, this is not a system where one would want to test that, because it's a developing slice culture and there are new connections being formed all the time. And it takes several days to go from labeling in one cell to labeling in the connected cells that is detectable.
Where did you put the virus?
Yeah, so I'm going to explain that in a minute, but the virus was put over the whole slice culture, but it only infected that one cell, and you'll see in a minute how that's done. Yeah, there's another one here. It's red, but it's not green, so I'm going to say in a minute how we transfected these cells. We didn't transfect initially just one cell in the slice. You'll see some examples later that there actually are multiple cells. But in this particular case, it seems likely that all these here come from this one cell, and that this cell didn't get infected with the virus. Okay, so how do we make it so the virus will go only one step and then stop? So presuming we can get the virus selectively into this one cell, which we'll see in a minute, what we've done is we've deleted a gene from the genome of the virus that's required for the virus to be able to spread. And then we introduce DNA into this one cell that codes for that missing gene. So this is called transcomplementation. And so the missing gene gets expressed, so there's protein here that then allows the virus to spread from this infected cell. There's GFP in the genome of the virus, so the cell turns green. So this transcomplementation will allow the virus to spread to directly connected cells. But remember, that gene is missing from the viral genome, so it doesn't go across with the virus. This plasmid is separate from the virus and doesn't get incorporated in any way. So these cells now are unable to have virus spread further to their synaptic partner. So that's how you can restrict to a single synaptic step. So how do we selectively infect? Well, this is related to the gene that we've deleted. And the gene that we've deleted from the genome is the glycoprotein gene. So there are only 5 genes in rabies virus. So here's a schematic of a rabies viral particle. It has RNA. It's an RNA virus. There are proteins, polymerase, some nucleocapsid, other things that are made by those 5 genes that are incorporated here inside the cell. But then what these red triangles represent are glycoprotein. So they're embedded in this envelope or membrane. So it's a host cell-derived membrane. So as a viral particle forms, envelope protein gets embedded at postsynaptic sites at the synapse. And then one of the structural components here, a matrix protein, then interacts with the glycoprotein, causing fusion and creation of this particle that can then bud out with the host cell-derived membrane. And so this glycoprotein is absolutely required to allow the virus to get out, and it's also required for uptake at the presynaptic terminal, so the virus can spread to the presynaptic terminal. So a cell that gets infected with a gene, with a virus like this that's missing the glycoprotein, the virus won't be able to get out. So to make a particle like this, we have to grow it in culture and express the glycoprotein gene in trans. Okay? But what we've used is not particles that look like this. Instead, we use particles that look like this. Instead of growing them in cultured cells that express rabies glycoprotein, we can express an envelope protein from a different virus. So the envelope protein determines how the virus will infect through receptors for the envelope protein. So by making what's called now a pseudotyped virus that expresses on its surface a different envelope protein, we can change the infectious properties. So we've used the envelope protein from avian sarcoma and leucosis virus type A, that's called NBA. And if you make a virus like this and put it in the brain of a mammal, it won't infect anything because there aren't any receptors for it. But we know what the receptor is for it. John Young, who's our colleague at the Salk Institute, discovered this when he was a postdoc 15 or 20 years ago. The receptor for this virus is called TVA, and we can express that in cells that we choose. And now only those cells will be susceptible to infection with this virus. So that's how we get selective infection. And here's an experiment that shows that works. So in these experiments in slice cultures, we use biolistics transfection. So a gene gun borrowed from Chuck shoots gold particles into the slice, and those gold particles are coated with DNA. So those kind of go all over the slice, and just by chance, occasionally they'll get into the nucleus, a place where the genes can get expressed. So here we express two genes, coat the gold particles with two things. One is DS-RED, just to mark the cells red so we know which ones got hit. And then TVA, which is the receptor for the pseudotyped virus. And in this case, we now put on the pseudotyped virus that has a glycoprotein gene deleted and replaced with GFP. We see that only red cells turn green. So you see that that shows that the infection is selective for the cells that express TVA, and it shows that the virus can't spread out of those cells. And then if we simply add the rabies glycoprotein gene in addition to the TVA and DS-RED, this now allows for the transcomplementation that when you put the virus on, now the virus spreads to neighboring cells. Okay. And there's that picture, and here's more typical, sort of what Tanya alluded to, that really you get lots of red cells sort of randomly scattered. And this makes sort of the next step difficult in that if you have something like this, you have two different red cells. So if you had a green cell, you don't know if it got green because it was connected to that cell or that cell. Nevertheless, we did some experiments to test the specificity of spread. We did paired recordings.
Is it retrograde?
It's retrograde. So it goes from the infected cell to the presynaptic cells. Right.
It's, so it's a statement to use the gene gun instead of pulling a slice of multiple
regions. Yeah, that's right. So it's a problem with the gene gun that you get multiple cells. And so I would wish that we had been able to solve this problem before we published the paper, but now a year and a half later, we finally can do single cell electroporation reliably, and we're going to go back and redo these experiments where we know that there's always just one cell in the slice that's been transfected. Right? At any rate, when we did these experiments, there were always some other red cells close by. So when we recorded from a green cell and stimulated it, we could see synaptic currents in red cells. But this was 9 out of 11 cases, so a small sample and two cases that were not connected that we could detect. So we don't know if that's because they got labeled indiscriminately or because there was some other red cell close by or maybe even a red cell that had been there and died. There are a lot of cells that die in these slice cultures. So, and then of cells that were not green that were just as close by, there were never connections from 10. So we need to go back and do that much better. And then we also need to do the thing that is, you know, how many cells are connected? Are they all connected? So now that we can electroporate single cells in vivo, where the connection should be more stable, we want to have whatever population of cells labeled get labeled. We're now able to modify the genome of the rabies virus. We've put a synaptophysin tag GFP in there, so it should label presynaptic terminals. So then with Mark Ellisman, we plan to do electron microscopy and to sample some subset of the postsynaptic sites on a single cell. And hopefully every synaptic site has label in a presynaptic terminal, and that would indicate that we're labeling all of the cells.
So, I mean, do we have any estimate of the number of false negatives?
Well, so that's exactly the experiment that I described just now, right? So what would be the rate of false negatives? And does it depend on, you know, maybe some parts of the brain, there are certain cell types that aren't as susceptible to infection and might give false negatives more often than others. So my hope would be that when we do that experiment, when we do the EM, we'll find that every postsynaptic site we look at has a labeled presynaptic terminal. And that would mean that there just aren't any false negatives. Or we might get some other answer that might be that 5% of the time they're not labeled, and that might mean we should try to understand, you know, what do those 5% have in common? Maybe there are dynamic changes in the circuitry, and, you know, because there's a 3-day lag between you know, when a cell is infected and there's a connection that you can detect it in the presynaptic cell, that maybe new connections got formed, and that's why. So.
Hypothetically, it could be that the number of synaptic contacts
are determined.
So there's a certain cell type which forms a lot of
accidents. Yeah. Yeah, so one of the things I haven't said is that the rabies virus, the way we use it, the way the system is designed, is able to replicate. So even though it can't spread from a labeled presynaptic cell, another synaptic step, it still is able to replicate. And rabies does that infinitely well. That is, a single particle of rabies virus in an animal's brain, if it's a wild type virus, will kill the animal. So I think that it's pretty likely that even a single synaptic contact, given enough time that there is some probability that a viral particle will spread across it, would get labeled. So I think it's, I won't be too surprised if the proportion of presynaptic terminals that get labeled in these cases is very close to 100%. But yeah, you're right. The probability that it spreads is completely dependent on the number of terminals. Yeah. So you might worry. So this is one of the reasons we wanted to make things go one synapse and stop, is that all the experiments before using rabies virus, which indiscriminately label all cells, and then allow it to go multiple synapse, people try to infer based on the amount of time that they wait, whether it's gone one synapse or two synapses, and that's, you know, dependent on the strength of connections and probably also dependent on how far out on the dendrites they are. If we use, we've done lots of experiments in monkeys using rabies like that to trace connections. And if you look at cells that have just been newly infected with rabies virus and you stain for the actual viral particles, you see that most of those particles initially are more proximal in the proximal dendrites. You wait longer, you now start to see all those particles go out and fill out way out in the dendritic arbor. So eventually it does. What's that?
Do you see infection in other brain areas?
With what? With
respect to the lesion that transfected cell, do you see?
Yeah. So all this that I showed you is in a slice culture, right? So there are no other brain areas, right? Right. So I don't know. Right. So we're doing those experiments now in vivo with the single cell, and I think we will. But yeah, we haven't. We've just got like one or two cases now where that's worked. Using this method, we certainly see, which is a different method, but you can imagine now that I've shown you a way that if we introduce two genes into a cell, we can selectively infect that cell and then label cells that are presynaptic to it. So that should also work and does for a population of cells, and you can use genetic methods to target these genes to a population of a specific type. So we have lines of mice that have Cre recombinase in specific cell types. We put a virus in that has Cre-dependent expression of these, and then we add the rabies in. So that is a method that's working.
How do you infect a single cell?
So I really went over that quickly. So it's possible to electroporate DNA into a single cell. So this is done by having a glass pipette that has DNA in it. And initially what we were doing, which was very unreliable, was to go in with a pipette, and you can measure, make electrical recordings, look for a change in resistance at the pipette tip, which tells you you're close to a cell, and you've got a little positive pressure on the pipette, and you release the positive pressure, and you get kind of a loose seal onto the cell, and you can measure action potentials, so you know you're on a cell. And then you put very high voltage, for brief steps, takes second to then drive DNA out of the cell, and that current then also makes pores in the membrane. Turns out if you do it the way I just described, you're probably too close to the cell, and the cells usually get killed. So more recently, Michael Hauser showed that by visualizing with multiphoton imaging, seeing the cell that you're aiming for, you get close to it, but not so close that you can measure action potentials, and then you electroporate. The amount of voltage that's required to get DNA out of the pipette, you're a little bit further away now. You don't damage the cell so much, and it survives. These are sort of inference guesses of what's going on. But the empirical observation is you do it visually, and now you're up to 80% success rate instead of sometimes 10%, and sometimes you go months with nothing. So you can actually just look at, you know, and now that we're using multiphoton imaging in vivo, we can electroporate a cell, go back a day or two later, visualize and actually see the cell that's expressing the gene, the GFP that we electroporated into that cell, and we can see that there aren't any other cells. Then we put the virus on.
But by visualizing, you should be able to tell immediately whether or not the cell survives, right?
Exactly, yeah. So
the success rate doesn't matter as much. You just keep on doing it until the cell survives.
Right. Well, I mean, it still matters. I mean, you've got to set up, do surgery, get imaging working, electroporate. So there's a lot of work every day to do that.
And then if the cell dies, you just move.
Oh, yes. So, it's not clear that they die right away.
Right. They can't tell
immediately. Yeah.
Can't tell
immediately. But, and I couldn't tell you what it is in the case of the deck, because we're trying to make them not die, and now that we're visualizing, they're not dying so much. Right. But at the time when we electroporate, there's also alexiflor that's negatively charged in the pipette, and we see that go into the cell. Occasionally, you zap it, and you don't see the alexiflor go in, so you zap it again. Back when we did dextran dye labeling, there's a different level of current. If we looked at cells within a few hours, or even recorded from them, very healthy for many hours. But if you look 3 days later, the cells are gone. So they might die later.
You're looking at the superganglion layers.
Yeah, it's all superficial layers, because you can image a few hundred microns deep at least. And people like David who are better, and maybe as we get better, we'll image deeper. But yeah. So, doing that way is limited to that. I hope that as we learn more about electroporation, we will be able to electroporate blindly more efficiently. Now that we understand that we're too close when we're measuring action potentials, we can simply just move back off from the cell before you electroporate and have a higher success rate. Because one of the things that I hope we'll be able to do is to measure the visual response of a neuron in monkey's primary visual cortex, and then label all the inputs to that exact same cell, so I can directly correlate the visual response of a cell with the circuitry of that cell.
And obviously, you have to be in a perisomatic location.
Yeah. So we've done lots of recordings with loose patch in monkey V1, and you can record for hours and get really nice, beautiful visual responses. And in those cases, we tried to label with dextran, and the cells usually ended up dying. So our yield was pretty low in those cases. But it's possible to do the recording. So hopefully we get better at also combining that with electroporation.
Also, is there a tool you develop too, which is one species versus other mammals or other vertebrates?
Yeah, rabies for sure works in lots of mammalian species. We did one experiment in Xenopus where we injected some of this rabies injected a bunch of little Xenopus into the colliculus. And Chris Kintner looked at those and didn't see anything in the retinas. So it might be
that I'm just really
bad at making injections. I was the guy who was vaccinated for rabies and could make them. Or it might be that it doesn't work in Xenopus. When you inject rabies locally, like I did in that experiment, you're relying on uptake from axon terminals. And it may be that the mechanisms that are working to help us here with getting sort of synapse specificity, that is, maybe the glial ensheathment that's there makes it so that when the virus buds out at a synaptic site, it doesn't spread, actually work against us. If I'm injecting virus just into the extracellular space, it might not get access to the presynaptic terminal that has the receptors for the viral particles. So just because it didn't work there doesn't mean it won't work. Maybe if we expressed TVA in some cells in a frog, I'm almost positive that we had TVA in cells in a frog, I could get virus into those cells. And then the question would be, can it spread from those cells to presynaptic terminals when you have a real, synaptic contact and whatever as well. So there's, I wouldn't completely lose hope for people who want to try and flies also. So, yeah.
It's sort of theoretical, but brain is a small world network, right? So I guess you can label neurons which are connected by the second degree connections, third degree connections. At some point, you label the entire brain, right? Have you thought of it's a limitation of this method where it's actually you can take advantage of it?
Yeah, there are ways you can extend this. I mean, we got kind of our hands full doing, just the basic one step, but. Sort of one of the points in this last slide is that we can put anything we want into the genome of the rabies virus, and there are ways that we've thought of to do this. So going across another synaptic step and seeing how far before you label the whole brain, one way to do that is we have put into the viral genome an inducible Cre recombinase. And Martin Goulding's lab is generating mice that following Cre recombination will express the rabies glycoprotein. Right. So say we label one cell, let the rabies virus spread to all the presynaptic cells, and that rabies is carrying an inducible Cre recombinase. So now we give the animal some tamoxifen that activates the Cre, allows glycoprotein to be expressed in those presynaptic cells. Now it can go another synaptic step. And you can do that and do that and do that. And if it turns out we can reliably induce with tamoxifen and each time it will go one synaptic step, that's one way to do that. Another way is that we can put, in addition to TVA, NVA, there's TVB, NV, TVE, there's HIV receptors, there's lots of viral receptors, and you can express, say, TVB, so that you go from one cell to the other cells, they all have TVB. So now we go with an NV virus and put it on those cells and go another step. And so there are ways you can imagine. Or you can have two different cells and infect one with TVA, express TVA in one, TVB in the other, and have a red virus in one, a green virus in the other. And then you can ask, do the connections of these cells directly depend on the shared input from other cells? So, So I'm done. So.
Just in a more general sense, like, is there a coherent effort to make Cre animals at every obvious locus, or is it kind of catch cat?
There's starting to be concerted efforts. There was the GenSat project with back transgenics, and for various reasons, not all those lines have been characterized. Some of them might be good, some might not. But the Allen Institute is now doing that. And they're going after, they're pretty far along. They've got like 170 lines in the pipeline. And they're using their information about cell type specific genes. So they're going after cell types, mostly inhibitory neurons and different types of layer 5 neurons. So also genes that are expressed in specific layers they're going after. And they're making knock-ins. They're not doing the transgenics. And so now it turns out that the best knock-ins are ones that don't affect endogenous gene expression. So they've been made, say, with an iris element downstream rather than upstream, an internal ribosomal entry site. So you make a single RNA that codes for, say, parvalbumin, but then it has kind of linked to it this next gene. An internal ribosome entry site makes it so a ribosome that translates it can come in internally. That's relatively inefficient. So now what in the last couple of years people have started using, and we've been using them in the lab, there are some elements that are in viral genomes called 2A elements, and they're self-cleaving so that as a ribosome translates along, so you make one big long RNA that has coding sequence for, say, parvalbumin and Cre recombinase. But as the ribosome goes and translates that, when it starts to translate the sequence, it makes a protein that interacts with the RNA and cuts, and the protein chain gets cut. So it makes a separate protein. And it adds a couple of extra amino acids on one end, but it's very efficient. Like, you get the stoichiometry of the two genes is very near 1-to-1. So, but that's not to say that now that you've made an RNA that's twice as long, that the amount of RNA might be lower, the translation, transcription might have been affected. But it's much better than losing one copy of the gene and like you do in most knock-ins. And these really recapitulate gene expression very faithfully. Yeah.